Today is Friday, January 4th, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Coming up, as the partial shutdown of the U.S. government reaches the two-week point, the president and Democrats are talking again. We'll go to the White House for the latest. We'll tell you about a cyber attack against German politicians. We'll have a look at the slowing sales of Apple's iPhone. And we'll visit Senegal's new Museum of Black Civilizations. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump has invited congressional leaders to the White House again today to continue negotiations on ending the partial government shutdown. Joining me is VOA White House correspondent Patsy Whitakaswara. Patsy, thanks for joining us. The newly Democratic-led House approved a series of bills yesterday that would reopen the government. Has President Trump signaled if he will sign the legislation?
I believe that he's actually signaling the opposite, that he will not sign anything without wall funding. Like Vice President Mike Pence said, no wall, no deal. And the president himself made a surprise appearance yesterday at the press briefing room, where he brought with him Immigration and Customs and Border Patrol agents to advocate for his demand for wall funding. I mean, it took us journalists completely by surprise. It seemed to be hastily arranged. We were only given a five-minute warning that there will be a press briefing, and we all ran to the briefing room, and then the president came and spoke for the first time ever in that venue to push for the wall. And the agents themselves also pushed for wall funding by saying that illegal immigration, drug smuggling was out of control, that murderers and rapists are coming into this country on a daily basis. And this morning, also, President Trump sent a letter to members of Congress on the need to secure borders. So it all seems to indicate that he is not budging.
Well, hearing the rhetoric from both sides, it sounds like both President Trump and the Democrats are digging in their heels over funding for a border wall. What can we expect at today's talks?
Well, it's happening right now as we speak. And at this point, it's really hard to see how Speaker Pelosi and President Trump can craft a deal to end this partial government shutdown, because there's simply no political incentive for either of them. Speaker Pelosi has just been elected. She has the power. She has the Democrats behind her. And she very clearly said last night, we're not doing the wall. Meanwhile, President Trump believes he's supported by his base, even though most polls show that Americans do not want the government to be closed over this wall fight. So the only way out of this, it seems, is if Republicans in Congress can put enough pressure on President Trump to make a deal. We know there's a handful of Republican lawmakers who supported the bill that Speaker Pelosi put out, including two Republican senators. But we'll see how this meeting goes. And we know that there seems to be preparation for a statement after the meeting in the Rose Garden, because I see some cameras being set up there.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Now, the shutdown debate marks the first time President Trump has faced an opposition party in power following 2 years of complete Republican control of government. Will this force Mr. Trump to change his negotiating style?
Well, it will certainly be a much more hostile political environment. I mean, there's already some fringe talk by new members about impeachment, for example. But whether this will change the president's style, from what he's in office, shows that when he is cornered or not getting what he wants, he digs his heels and doubles down. He never admits defeat. In fact, he will call it victory, as he had done after the Democrats won in 2018. Having said that, President Trump knows that he needs the Democrats to make deals, and he likes making deals. He likes to be seen as a successful deal maker. And so there may be areas of bipartisan support on issues that he cares about, such as the recent prison reform legislation, and possibly ahead on issues such as infrastructure and lowering the cost of prescription drugs.
Well, heading back to the shutdown debate again, has either side quietly suggested a compromise that could end the shutdown?
Well, we know that Vice President Mike Pence did some back-channel negotiation, offering the possibility of the White House accepting $2.5 billion. That's half of what the president has publicly demanded. But then on Wednesday, the president said, no, 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 that's not what we want. We want $5.6 billion. So there's clearly some frustration from the Democrats, who feel that they can't trust people from the administration to say what the president will or will not accept, only to be contradicted by the president later. In fact, they don't even trust the president, and they worry that he will say one thing and then change his mind, as he has done so in the past. And I think one of the most revealing remarks on the way the Democrats want to handle this was made by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, who said in an into what he calls the president's temper tantrum, because then he will just do it again and again in the future. So, you know, as far as compromise goes, there are very public calls for compromise from lawmakers in the White House, but so far it's still calling for the other side to compromise.
Well, Patsy, we know you'll stay on top of this for us, and we'll be talking to you probably again in the near future. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Among the top stories in the world, Britain's foreign minister says he is extremely worried about former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, a dual U.S.-British citizen who has been detained in Russia on espionage charges. A Chinese rover has driven onto the moon's surface, the first to explore the far side of the moon. A U.S. immigration judge is ending deportation proceedings against a mentally disabled Hispanic man. And a powerful tropical storm made landfall Friday in southern Thailand in what is expected to be the worst storm to pound the Southeast Asian country in 30 years. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say that for about the first half of Earth's history, there was virtually no real free or breathable oxygen in the atmosphere. Then, about 2.3 to 2.5 billion years ago, blue-green algae called cyanobacteria living in the Earth's oceans began emitting enough oxygen through photosynthesis to create the permanently oxygenated atmosphere that keeps us alive today. This process, which scientists say took about 100 million years, is called the Great Oxidation Event. New research led by Imperial College London suggests that early photosynthesis from ancestors of that cyanobacteria may have produced bursts of oxygen about 1 billion years before this great oxidation event. Other studies suggest these early bursts of oxygen were chemically captured by dissolved iron or organic material before it had the chance to oxygenate the atmosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
And thank you for joining me on a Friday for VOA's International Edition. Here in the studio with me is VOA's national security correspondent, Jeff Selden. Jeff, we have a number of things to discuss today, and let's begin with President Trump's comments earlier this week about, well, actually, he was defending his decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Are decisions like this straining his relationship with the U.S. military?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And it would seem that at least with military leadership, the answer would be yes. And remember, during the pool spray that they held, where he went on for about an hour and a half before actually going into the cabinet meeting, he was on one side of him. He had the new acting defense secretary, Pat Shanahan. Other cabinet members were there. And he didn't only defend his decision to pull out from Syria, but he also criticized his generals. And remember, it used to be that he would say he had the greatest generals, and he would talk about his generals, and he would talk about Mattis as one of his generals, Jim Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense, who resigned and whose last day was December 31st over differences with the Syria policy. So he criticized Mattis, but he also criticized his generals on Afghanistan, saying he had given them all the money that they asked for, that they wanted. He raised their budget so they could buy more weapons, train more troops, get more equipment. And what had they done? You know, he said, and he dismissed the notion of the need for the U.S. to participate in what he termed endless wars, even going as far to refer to Syria as sand and death, sand and blood, in defending his decision to pull out. So you do have this tension, because in the way he talked about some of those things, in the way he defended Russia's invasion in 1979 of Afghanistan, which drew a lot of attention because it contradicts what most historians say. He said that Russia was right to go into Afghanistan because Afghanistan was sending terrorists into Russia. That contradicts what the State Department has said on its websites, in the material it's put out. It contradicts what the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, has on its own website about the war in Afghanistan, and many historical recollections and papers and books on the matter. So by saying that, he contradicted in two ways his own national defense strategy as it was put together by former Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, which was about staying strong with allies, needing to combat groups like ISIS and give them an enduring defeat, but also standing strong against adversaries in this era of great power competition in which Russia is listed in one of those great powers. So he criticized his generals, he lashed out at his former defense secretary, and he kind of took his national defense strategy and threw it away. But there's another. But that's with leadership. At the same time, you have these images that we see when he visited the troops in Iraq, when he holds rallies in military bases, which, again, brings up some criticism from some military brass and especially former military leaders, where he's politicizing the military. But you see the reception he gets, the cheers, the raucous type of atmosphere. So, how is it overall affecting his military, his relationship with the military? Hard to say. Are there rank and file who like him, who support him, and who would say they would vote for him again? Yes, but there have been some polls. The Military Times, a newspaper that covers the military, said that in October, support seemed to be waning. So where does this go? It remains to be seen. But all this, as this plays out, remember, since day one, since he was inaugurated in his first day in office, he's had a very contentious relationship with the U.S. intelligence community. So clearly, President Trump is not afraid of making enemies within the military.
We only have a few minutes, and there's a lot that I want to get to. And you'd brought up Afghanistan, which is one of the things I want to discuss. There are reports that Mr. Trump plans to pull out half of the U.S. troops currently there, just as peace negotiations are gaining traction with the Taliban. What are you hearing about this?
Well, the senior administration officials have said there's been no order put out asking half of the troops to half of the about 14,000 troops in Afghanistan to pull out of the country. But there have been numerous reports that it's something that's under consideration. The president himself, during his cabinet meeting, voiced displeasure with what he called the endless war in Afghanistan. So clearly there's a desire to pull out. What this means for the Taliban is unclear. The Taliban have always played this game, according to military officials, intelligence sources, of trying to wait the U.S. out, thinking they have more patience. And still, the latest reports coming out of the Pentagon from the Inspector General looking at the effort in Afghanistan, it's still going to be some time before the Afghan forces themselves can stand up and defend against the Taliban and rule the country on their own. Right now, U.S. help is still viewed as critical. So how do you walk that line? That's something that a lot of people are waiting to hear from this administration.
All right, Jeff, there's always so much to chat with you about. We're going to have you back again soon to discuss some other issues. Jeff Seldon, our VOA National Security Correspondent, thank you for joining us.
Anytime.
And you're listening to International Edition from VOA. In Germany, there's been a major cybersecurity breach. Chancellor Angela Merkel is reportedly among hundreds of German politicians who have had personal data, including credit card details and mobile phone numbers, released online. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
From credit card details to mobile phone numbers, the personal data of hundreds of German politicians has been leaked online. And it's a hacking attack that's reportedly also affected Chancellor Angela Merkel. Though a government spokesperson said that it seems no sensitive information from her office had been released. The data was published on a Twitter account and included addresses, personal letters, and copies of identity cards. Every major German political party was targeted, except one, the far-right Alternative for Deutschland. But sources inside the state security agency, cited by media, said the secure internal network of Germany's government was not hit. Germany's National Cyber Defense Body met on Friday morning to coordinate the response of federal government agencies, including the domestic and foreign intelligence services. The identity of the hackers and their motive is still unknown.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. This is VOA's International Edition.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
I'm Jim Bertel, and this is VOA's International Edition. Global markets continue the global sell-off triggered by Apple's warning of lower revenues. But U.S. stocks are rebounding in midday trading due to a strong jobs report and gains by tech stocks, including Apple, which is up after Thursday's huge losses. The drop came after Apple said sales of its devices had fallen sharply in China last month, perhaps signaling a broader slowing in the world economy. Apple's warning, its first since 2002, deepened concerns about the Chinese economy, which had been showing signs of stress amid a trade war with the United States. VOA's Lori London talked about this with Peter Morrissey, an economist and professor of international business at the R.H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland. She asked for his reaction to Apple CEO Tim Cook's message about the trade war with China dramatically impacting its sales.
Oh, I think Tim Cook was looking for excuses. So he blamed the trade war and he blamed conditions in China. The reality is the market's saturated. He sells a very expensive phone. He doesn't have many low-cost options. And he raised prices a great deal, some as much as 20 or so percent on the less expensive phones. And he's discovered that people will buy other phones. They'll make the phones they have last longer. Tim Cook needs to find a new business model. Simply jacking up the price of an iPhone every year no longer works.
Not many people can afford to pay $1,000 for a cell phone. That's certain.
And more, because every time you buy an iPhone, all the peripherals have to change too. They got to have it structured that way. They seem to believe that people wanted to spend all their discretionary income at the iPhone store, and that is silly. More than that, Tim Cook is at a bit of a loss as to find other businesses. They are growing, but some of this stuff is absolutely comical. For example, I think, you know, all of a sudden he's Howard Hughes running RKO. He's going to have his own media business for Apple TV, and he's putting his hand into it. He's decided that, you know, the kind of content they're going to have. It sort of reminds me of my fantasies in managing the New York Yankees. Tim Cook knows how to make phones with cheap labor in China. They're elegantly designed. They're beautiful phones. But that's what he knows how to do.
Besides the situation with Apple, do you think that this trade war with China and the United States is starting to hurt folks in China and the U.S.? Do you think it's actually becoming...
No, it kind of reminds me of Coca-Cola blaming the steel tariffs for its troubles. Coca-Cola doesn't use any steel. Coca-Cola sells concentrate to bottlers, and bottlers are spending a couple of pennies more per six-pack on cans, you know, because of the aluminum. Most of the tariffs that Donald Trump has imposed are 10%. The value of the yuan since April has gone down almost 10%. So how can they have much of a pricing effect? The reality is that China has got endemic structural problems that it has to address. It has studied very closely the Japanese experience, but it seems to have quit around inning six. It doesn't seem to want to go to the end of the game in that diary where Japan runs out of space to export to the United States. What China has done is exported so much to the United States and caused so much dislocation in the middle of the country that U.S. growth is slowed to the point that there are absolute limits to what China can send here. What's more, the Chinese are endemic thieves and fundamentally dishonest. They don't seem to ever be able to go into a situation where they don't want to get the better end of things. Think of how much of this message is pushing back on President Xi. He's getting a lot of heat from the next level down about the reputational problems the Chinese have these days because of their kind of behavior. And the State Department just issued a warning to Americans about travel to China because you may get arrested. They're trumping up charges. People go on tours. They're trumping up charges to seize Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've always done that to Chinese nationals that come and study abroad and then go home and they'd say, well, you weren't very faithful in your comments. But now the State Department is now warning Americans not to go to China.
So who wins in this trade war? Do we win? Will we ultimately get it resolved? We have negotiations next week. There are formal talks next week.
There's a lot of pressure on Xi and on Trump to deal. On Xi because of economic conditions at home and the political pressures, he doesn't seem to be as invulnerable as he was 6 months ago. But Trump has staked so much on the stock market, you know, being a barometer of his success, that the troubles in the U.S. stock market have nothing to do with the trade war, nothing whatsoever. They have to do with the fact that the five principal tech companies each have a problem like Apple's. With Netflix, it's other media companies cropping up and a terrible upheaval among its workforce that the place is, you know, not a good place to work. It's terribly unfair. Google and Amazon have got antitrust problems. Google's got a bullseye on its chest for its invasion of privacy, and on it goes. I mean, just every one of the fangs has got problems, and they have been responsible for most of the run-up in the market. Now, what that means is other companies are greatly undervalued because they haven't been rising nearly as much.
That's Peter Morrissey, an economist and professor at the University of Maryland. Ending our dependence on carbon in all of its forms is a constant endeavor of engineers and entrepreneurs. VOA's Kevin Enochs has more.
It seems so simple. Take some plastic and drop it into this contraption, add heat, and out comes diesel fuel and petrol that can instantly be used to run a diesel generator. Surprisingly, says inventor Christopher Cost, it is that simple.
A kilo of plastic gives a liter of liquid. It's separated between diesel and petrol.
The team that put this device together says the goal is to keep the units small and affordable. That should allow developing countries to create fuel and help cut down on plastic waste, says François Denel of the French environmental group Earthwake.
The mission of this machine is to collect plastic waste, especially in developing countries, and to create value and jobs. We want the model to be economically sustainable so it can be duplicated more and more as time goes by.
And this is the Nexo, a new fuel cell car from Hyundai. Product manager Sylvie Chile says its only emission is clean oxygen.
To make the car run, you need oxygen and hydrogen, which in the fuel cell stack are mixed. There's a chemical reaction and that produces electricity. To get oxygen, we don't carry the oxygen on board. We use the oxygen that is contained in the air as we drive through.
But that oxygen has to be incredibly clean, so it's run through three different filters before it's used to help power the car. And then it's sent back into the atmosphere, cleaner than when it went in. The Hyundai engineers say driving 1.6 kilometers in their Nexo removes the same amount of pollution that a diesel truck puts into the atmosphere every 3.2 kilometers. Kevin Enochs, VOA News.
There's a new museum in Senegal, the Museum of Black Civilizations, opened to the general public this week. Ricky Shyrock has more.
Senegal's Museum of Black Civilizations is now open to the public. The four-story structure is home to one of Africa's largest art collections and has room for 18,000 works in all. Visitors on the first day, like Solange Lopez, expressed enthusiasm for the new institution. She says she loves it, and it is really impressive. It is really magnificent to have so much African art brought together here, she says, because it is from here. It is from Africa. The museum opening comes amid global calls for European countries to return African art looted during the colonial era. A recent report commissioned by French President Emmanuel Macron identified 46,000 objects at the Musée du Quai Branly Museum in Paris that would qualify for repatriation. Corinne John from Texas visited the museum on opening day with her husband, Amdalai John, who grew up in Senegal. She thinks the museum would be a great spot for visitors to see African art on the African continent. She says European countries should return the artifacts.
This is the time to do it. I think this will be a great way to be able to bring the African art back to Africa and give people a central location that they can go and see.
Museum Director Hamadi Bokoum says the museum will be a space for conversation on a global scale.
That was Ricky Shyrock reporting. Well, you've been listening to International Edition, and you can find us at voanews.com. I want to give our thanks out to director Dan Brown and our engineer Nick Ivanov. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Have a great weekend.